As usual, let's begin with just a brief moment of silence, please. All right, thank you. So to kick things off today, we have a little activity as usual. So I'm going to ask you all to get into groups of two or three, and then imagine the following scenario. So President Obama has come to Golden Village and has experienced our way of life here and is very impressed. And he's been talking to some of you who have been coming to a couple of these sessions on wilderness and feels that you are very well versed in the ins and outs of the wilderness concept. And he has decided that he is going to open up all national parks in America to settlement. People can live inside the national parks now. But he needs a committee of well-informed people to come up with some policies or some, feel free to sit up here if you want to. I was going for the circle, but I guess that's not working out so much. He needs a group of people to come up with some policies and some regulations around what this should look like if people are going to be living inside national parks. So, for example, you might want to think about who should be allowed to live inside the national parks. What should living inside the national parks look like in terms of structures or buildings, in terms of livelihood? You name it. So this is sort of a broad assignment, and you can do with it what you will. So in groups of two or three or even four if you want to, just talk for a couple minutes about what policies you would put in place as advisors to Obama. Back together. So would any groups like to share some of the policies you came up with? So for starters, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Well, I'm just back from Spain, where my wife and I are fans of the Camino de Santiago. This ancient pilgrimage route goes across Spain and ends in Santiago de Compostela, where legend has it that the remains of St. James are buried. Anyhow, across Spain, there is a series of hostels, just a comfortable day's walk apart, anywhere from 10 to 15 miles. And I have often envisioned such a thing for the Pacific Crest Trail, if there was a series of hostels so that people walking it would not have to carry their tent and sleeping bag and food and all that. And these hostels would be supplied by local suppliers, and it would, in effect, create another industry which would leave the rest of the National Forest territories more or less untouched.
All right, so we've got the proposal for a strip, basically, of hostels or some kind of structure roughly a day's walk apart. Did anyone else come up with another vision for people living in the national parks? Go ahead.
Well, since our parks, for the most part, are really wilderness areas, and then land that was supposedly considered worthless, which was the main reason they put it in the park, I'd say nobody. You know, it should be there for visitors, but not for people. Certainly not living there.
Yeah.
On a permanent basis.
I heard that comment from a couple of people right when the assignment began. It sounds like you're not alone in hoping that no one will live there. But what if they're going to, no matter what? It's been opened, wide open, and people are going to be moving in. But this is your one opportunity to set a couple of policies about what that habitation will look like.
Like Holden.
Yeah. Well, little villages.
Okay.
Self-sustaining. Yeah.
So should anyone be allowed to live in the parks?
For the most part, it's an
So should people be allowed to do some farming, as much farming as they can, to grow food to support themselves living in these national parks? No farming. Okay. How about grazing? How about a couple grazing animals? Go ahead.
How about if they have to be nomadic and be hunter-gatherer?
All right. So
no,
there's a proposal.
No permanent dwellings. Maybe a summer residence and a winter residence. Maybe between parks. Who knows?
Snowbirds.
No, they can't have their. They can't have the modern conveniences. They have to. They have to live. Off the land.
So you're going to allow hunting in the national park?
Only with bow and arrow themselves. And no other hunting is allowed by anyone else.
All right. That's a very well thought out plan. Go ahead, David.
You said they'd have to make a commitment to stay inside the boundaries, like at least 6 months at a time. So the traffic in and out is reduced.
Okay. So you're allowing roads, it sounds like, into these establishments.
No, we didn't get that far.
Okay.
No paved roads.
No paved roads. Okay. Any last comments?
I just want to point out that that doesn't really match my experience of our national parks. People live there. There's lots of roads. There's infrastructure. There's lots of facilities for people who want to come and visit them. Already there.
There are, many of them are in specifically designated areas of the park, so it'll be often kind of like a main strip through the valley, and they'll sometimes be seasonal as well. So you're right, there's definitely already infrastructure in place. There's running water and electricity, and people live there, and sometimes year-round. This idea would be that any area beyond that particular zone would be thrown wide open, any wilderness area. So in Yosemite, for example, instead of just being Yosemite Valley that has buildings, you could live anywhere you wanted to in all of the valley. And it sounds like there's some discomfort with that idea. It sounds like we don't really like that very much.
A lot of people now have 99-year leases, and I think that's a travesty. I think it's maybe a couple of years would be plenty.
All right. Well, last comment.
What would happen if we used them the way they've tried to make it for some places like in Kenya and their big national parks, if they became the rangers of the park? I mean, there are rangers now living in the park, and they move around quite a bit, actually, in parks.
What a perfect segue into our first topic, exporting wilderness to the global south. So this activity was intended just to get the wheels turning a little bit, get you thinking about, again, this dichotomy we've been talking about for several days between the human realm and then the wilderness realm and the seemingly separateness of those two. So today we're going to look at wilderness from the margins, and I want to talk very briefly about what that means, to think about something from the margins. So when... So if I put myself right now kind of in the center of the room, I have a certain perspective, and it's a little bit different than your perspective if you're sitting on the edge and looking at the rest of the room in that way. And the idea is that in our society, we tend to have dominant perspectives that tend to control the way that most of us perceive things or think about things. And there's perspectives other than that, often that exist on the margins. They're less dominant, less hegemonic, less entrenched, that we have often been taught to think of as less valid or less real or less true. So today we're going to be exploring a little bit of thoughts and voices from people whose social location doesn't match the mainstream. And by social location, I mean the location that you perceive yourself to have and that others perceive you to have in terms of your identity. So oftentimes that's perceived in terms of the gender you identify with, the race or ethnic group you identify with, your nationality, your sexual orientation. It can be your experience. It can even be, you know, your placement in the family. All of these things comprise how you see the world and how other people think that you see the world. So increasingly these days you come across scholars who right off the bat will say, I just want to tell you what my social location is so you know where I'm speaking from. And we're going to explore some social locations today. They're a little bit different than what we've been looking at for the last 3 days. So, for starters, many Romance languages lack a word for wilderness. Are there any French speakers out here? Does anyone know what the French word for wilderness would be? It's désert. It's like desert, or l'eau sauvage. I'll write this up here. So, desert or How about Spanish speakers? Anyone know what the Spanish would use for?
Desierto.
Desierto. Does that resonate with you, Maria?
Selva.
Selva?
Selva.
How do you spell that?
La selva.
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 Ambientes.
Ambientes.
Desierto. How about yermo? Would that yermo?
Yermo.
What would that? What does that mean? Not so much.
No.
Okay.
It's kind of empty.
Okay.
But yeah.
All right. So most Romance languages do not have a word that directly translates to what we think of as wilderness. And most of these languages came from around the Mediterranean, so they reflect these kind of stark areas around there. Germanic languages, however, including English, do have words for wilderness, and it often approximates something like a dark forest or a dismal swamp or mountain fastness. And then the extremes of this concept became desert and garden. We've been talking about this for a couple days now. And the fact that we have this word wilderness shapes our relationship to the land. The fact that it even exists in our language means something. It matters. So many cultures simply do not have this word at all. The Tarahumara of Mexico have no word for wilderness. They say land is granted the same love and affection as family, and they call it kincentric ecology. That's kind of the best approximate definition. The Nlaka Pamaks in Alberta call it basically a pantry. The closest word they have to wilderness is a pantry, a kitchen pantry. The Guinea in the Pacific, in Papua New Guinea, call it, the closest definition or the closest approximation would be an ongoing exchange of energy and spirit with their ancestors. That's the closest way they can come up with to describe wilderness. There's Ododham, which I think is an indigenous group in Canada, and their word for wilderness is health and wholeness and liveliness. So for many of these groups, when anthropologists will go, and I'm thinking of one in particular named Mark Dowie, who I'll talk a bit about today, would go and ask people questions about wilderness, they would pause in the interview and wait for him to explain what on earth he meant by that, because that word simply didn't exist in their understanding. So we're going to look at three different categories. We're going to talk briefly about what happens when we export the wilderness idea to the global south. We're going to talk about some indigenous and Native American perspectives on wilderness, and then end with an eco-feminist approach to what this term means. And as always, my disclaimer is that I'm not an expert on this, and I recognize that there's a lot of knowledge in this room, so let's all share what we know with each other and learn from each other. And then also one last thing I want to say before we dive in along the topic of social location is that keep in mind as we're going along that we're thinking about the concept of others and othering. And by that I mean othering is something that happens in systems of power. There are those who are us and there are those who are other. And people become codified in many ways, and some of them are considered to be less than human. So oftentimes women, people of color throughout history have been codified as somehow less than human. And today we're going to be thinking about why it is that some of these concepts of wilderness, especially in section two, are not the dominant understanding of wilderness, the Inuit understanding of wilderness as a backyard, basically, or as a source of food, is not what we think of today. And there's a reason why that has happened. So let's start with exporting wilderness to the global south. I'm going to tell you a story of a group of people in southern Uganda called the Batwa, who lived in the dense montane forest in southern Uganda for many, many years. They're in very close harmony with the forest. In fact, there was such a closeness that one naturalist described them as part of the fauna of the system. In the 1930s, Ugandan leaders were persuaded by international conservationists that this area was threatened by loggers and miners and extractive industries, and they should protect it somehow. So three forest reserves were created, and they all overlapped somewhat with the Batwa territory, but they pretty much just existed on paper. They existed on maps, so extractive industries couldn't go in there and extract resources. But for about 60 years, that's all that happened. It existed on a bunch of maps. But in about early 1990s, I think it was 1991, the reserve became a formal national park, and a bureaucracy was created, in this case through the World Bank's global environmental facility. And a rumor began to spread that the Batwa were killing silverback gorillas inside the park. This was a threatened species. This was also increasingly becoming an attraction for ecotourism, so there was a lot of concern. But when they were confronted, the Batwa said, yeah, the silverback gorillas are being killed, but not by us, by the Bantu, by the Batutsi and Bahutu people, and that they felt this deep kinship with the apes, and they would never poach them. But nevertheless, Western conservationists who believed that wilderness and human communities were essentially incompatible convinced the government to expel the Batwa people. So they were forced out of this land, and one account says that they were so used to living in this sort of dense forest that they were disoriented when they emerged and would sometimes even step into oncoming traffic and ended up living in these settlements outside of the park, these basically squatter camps. And it's predicted that within one generation there would be a complete loss of their tradition, their cultures, their songs that was so deeply rooted in this place where they had lived for so long. So for many of us, it might not be a surprise to hear that industries like big oil or big agriculture, big timber, have been known to force people off of their land. But now all of a sudden we're faced with a culprit that's seemingly much more noble, which is big conservation. And specifically, we're talking about the five biggest conservation organizations. I know three of them are World Wildlife Fund, Conservation International, the Nature Conservancy, I think Wilderness Conservation Society is another one. These are massive, massive organizations that exert a lot of influence and are now accused of being responsible for creating what we call conservation refugees. So this is a term that I think a man named Mark Dowie came up with, and he wrote a book called Conservation Refugees, and also a shorter article about it in Orion, in the magazine Orion, that won several awards. And it's basically a distinguish between ecological refugees, people who are forced off their land because of drought or flood or some kind of natural disaster, and instead these are people who are forced to relocate with tacit approval or benign neglect of these big international conservation organizations. They call them big international NGOs or bingos. That's the term for them.
When the other people do it, we call it ethnic cleansing. When we do it, it's something else.
Yeah, or specifically when conservation groups are behind this relocation for the purpose of protecting land for the sake of biodiversity or an animal species.
Well, it's a question of who owns the land. The people who have been there for 1,000 years? Or the guy who came and planted a pole and says, I claim this for my king?
This is exactly what we're getting into in this topic. Another story, a Maasai leader was at the World Conservation Congress in Bangkok in 2004. And presented this idea. He basically said, we, my people, are the enemies of conservation. We were the original conservationists. Our ways of farming pollinated diverse seed species and maintained corridors between ecosystems. And he had tried to fathom what he thought of as a very strange version of land conservation that impoverished over 100,000 of his people in South Kenya and Tanzania. And he basically told all of these white conservationists that we don't want to be like you, we want you to be like us. We are here to change your minds. You cannot accomplish conservation without us. Another story from northern Thailand in the early 2000s, a lot of generous financial offerings came in from the global environmental facility that allowed the Thai government to create dozens of land and marine parks on land that were occupied by hill people and fishing people, but was now managed by the forest department as protected areas. Does someone out there have quote A? It has a little A at the beginning of it. Can you read that for us all, please?
It's actually a capital A.
Capital A?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's, yeah, go ahead.
Is that the right one?
Yes.
Men in uniform just appeared one day out of nowhere, showing their guns and telling us that we were now living in a national park. That was the first we knew of it. Our own guns were confiscated. No more hunting, no more trapping, no more snaring, no more slash and burn. That's what they call our agriculture. We call it crop rotation, and we've been doing it in this valley for over 200 years. Soon we will be forced to sell rice to pay for grains and legumes. We are no longer
that was a firsthand account from a community leader in a small village in northern Thailand. In the 1990s, USAID pumped $300 million into the international conservation movement, which was seen as vital to economic prosperity. And about 70% of that ended up in the hands of these big international conservation organizations, specifically the five biggest ones. And indigenous groups received nothing. So these huge conservation organizations have changed over the last few years, and they've become really quite powerful. They have a lot of corporate sponsorship that they see as essential to the continuation of their work, including big oil companies who are hoping to work alongside them to, you know, in a cynical way, probably just improve their image. They have financial and political leverage. They have nine-figure budgets. And they've taken on a huge global push to expand the number of protected areas in the world. And the current estimate is that there's anywhere between 5 million and several tens of millions of conservation refugees at the moment. An example from India. In 2002, in the span of 3 months, the Indian government evicted 100,000 Adivasis, rural people, in Assam, and estimates that another 3 million would be evicted over the next decade. And this policy was almost entirely in response to a lawsuit brought about by the World Wildlife Fund in 1993 that demanded that the government increase protected areas by 8% in order to save tiger habitat in India. So, how did all of this happen? How did this come to be? Again, those of you who have been with us for the last 3 days have kind of seen this progression of this concept of wilderness. Muir argued that wilderness should be cleared of all inhabitants and set aside to satisfy the urban elite's need for recreation and spiritual renewal. And this sentiment was then institutionalized. It was written into the Wilderness Act of 1964. So there's this very Western and very American idea that humans don't belong in nature. And the dominant philosophy or worldview that we now have of nature is that natural areas need to be protected from human beings, need to be protected from the human beings that live there in order to protect them. I had a personal experience with this a little bit when I was a Peace Corps volunteer in the Philippines. I lived on a small island called Olongo Island, and it was very, very flat, and it had a migratory bird sanctuary because the tide would come in and go out so far. It was ideal for migratory shorebirds. And I would go there and work with the two or three employees there, and we would often see people from the local villages walking out into the tidal flats, and they were capturing shorebirds if they could to bring home and to eat, and they were collecting snails and shells, or just whatever they could, shells for decoration and any food that they could find. And my initial reaction was, this is a migratory bird sanctuary. This is a protected area. This is for the birds. It's why this exists. Shouldn't we be doing something about it? And I remember being surprised at their sort of nonchalance of my coworkers. They were like, they need food. They lived here and got food from this tidal flat long before it became a migratory bird sanctuary. This is how things are. And we never really got into it a whole lot more, but I remember always being a little bit disturbed because it didn't conform to my idea of what a protected area should look like. So there are a couple of solutions out there, although they're more of the exception than the rule. It often works when native people initiate the creation of some kind of a reserve, and it's often called an indigenous protected area or community conservation area. One example is Kayapo, the Amazonian Indians, who refused to be just another stakeholder at the table when they understood that their land was going to be turned into a protected area, and they demanded equal presence, equal rights, equal say in what it would look like. So this is now the first Indian-owned park in the country. And it honors the lifeways of the Indians who stay within the park boundaries. And this has been lauded as combining scientific knowledge and indigenous knowledge in the effort of preserving an area. Again, however, it's more the exception than the rule. For the most part, what we're seeing is the exportation of a very American idea of wilderness and national parks to the rest of the world, which is forcing people outside of those boundaries and starting up what Mark Dowie calls these conservation refugees. Are there any comments or questions at this point?
Yeah, are you submitting that all conservation refugees have a benign relationship with their environment when they're told to leave? I mean, is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
You're not noting that there are conditions in which there's an indigenous population that actually should be taken away from that environment.
What's your experience with that, or do you have an example or anything?
I'm just asking that.
No, I'm not arguing that all indigenous groups have a symbiotic relationship with the land around them. What I am saying, one other way to describe this would be, there's different ways that a conservation biologist and an anthropologist might approach a certain community in a certain space. And the conservation biologist might argue, look, there are these indigenous people that are so romanticized by anthropologists, but as soon as they get their hands on a chainsaw or modern technology or desire to have the same kind of lifestyle that they see happening in urban areas, they're going to destroy their own space around them. And that, you know, we should acknowledge that, we should stop romanticizing it. And then the anthropologists are saying, look at these ridiculous conservation biologists who don't acknowledge or don't recognize the ways in which over time these people have coexisted with their environment in a way that it might be hard for us to see, but really is sort of mutually enhancing. And the reason why the biodiversity exists in the first place is because they had been there for all these years and behaving in a certain way. So you're bringing up a very important and controversial issue. I don't really have an answer to it, but no, I'm not saying that every group has a completely symbiotic relationship with the land they live in. Yeah.
The words conservation and preservation seem to be used interchangeably in concept often in these discussions. How do they apply in some of these? Well, like you talked about the conservation refugees. Are they preservation refugees or are they conservation refugees?
So, does anyone who is here on Tuesday want to answer that? That's okay. There is a distinction between the terms. Preservationist emerges out of the John Muir tradition and is intended to refer much more to protecting an area and not touching it at all. So you basically make it out of bounds, except maybe to a very, very limited kind of low-impact recreation. And then conservation came out of the Gifford Pinchot tradition and referred much more to sustainable extraction of resources from these lands. So you conserve resources so that they can be used over time to benefit many, many people, but it's not off limits. I don't hear the word preservation used nearly as often, and I think oftentimes when people use conservation, they mean preservation. In this case, it probably just depends on the place. It depends on the park, whether it's truly an off-limits park or whether it's a protected area that the government or some corporations are allowed to use still to extract materials from. Does that answer your question at all?
Yes, starting.
Okay, over here.
I was wondering if you happen to know, or anybody happens to know, what happened to the land that the Batwa, is that right? That was started by the Batwa. What about the land after they got moved off?
Like what happened to it?
What happened to it? Did it change for the better or for the worse when people were taken away? Was that not tracked?
I don't know specifically what happened in southern Uganda, but we're going to talk a little bit in the second section of parts of land that were specifically Yosemite that was perceived to be a certain way when Muir and the early European settlers came in and thought of this as pure and unaffected wilderness that in fact only looked that way because the Miwok Indians and others had been actively cultivating the valley for many, many, many years. So I think that there's probably a lot of factors that affect what the park looks like afterwards, including were the other poachers able to be stopped even after the Batwa were relocated or not? Are there other people who are still living in that park or moving into the park or out? Would the vegetation slowly begin to look different over time? I would guess that it would, but there's also just so many different factors that are affecting what land looks like. I don't know. That's a great question. Yeah.
I apologize for not having been here to the previous discussion, but my observation with these types of problems is that there are too many people in the world.
Yeah, that's been a common sentiment, a little bit less so now, but a very common sentiment earlier in the environmental movement that this was the root of all of our problems. Yeah. Was there a hand over?
Yeah, I just wanted to add with your story about the Adivasi indigenous people from India, from Northeast India, Assam. Along the lines of the overpopulation comment, a lot of what I've observed happening in India is the Adivasi people being pushed into new land because they don't have ownership over the land, like in the Western sort of or established sort of sense. And so as there's urban sprawl and the cities grow bigger and bigger and bigger, it pushes them off of their native habitat. And so oftentimes as they're moving into these areas that are now becoming tiger-protected lands, it hasn't always been, in all cases, their original dwelling place, but it's a place that they've been pushed into with the urban sprawl.
Hmm. Thanks. So, one more comment over here.
Just that the wild places that we imagine that we can manage to maintain what we think they're supposed to look like because we arrived at a moment in time and decided that was wilderness at that time often has unintended consequences. And I was thinking about the elimination of the top predators, which resulted in the degradation and the decrease in biodiversity in some of our national parks because there were too many deer and elk, which we decided we liked better and didn't threaten us, and they ate all the understory. And so bringing the wolves back to Yellowstone, for example, has already shown that the biodiversity is coming back because it's keeping the grazers under control. So there's so many things that we think that we can do even if we remove the people from the landscape that we don't always know how it's going to unfold and what that's going to mean for that ecosystem.
Mm-hmm. That's a great point. So a couple closing thoughts for this first section. Interestingly enough, conservation in the 20th century has resulted in a loss of biodiversity. There's been a higher rate of extinctions, and one theory is that the reason why is because we've removed the very people who may have been responsible for that biodiversity. Some people will argue that increasingly we're trying to save biological diversity at the expense of cultural diversity, and oftentimes it's cultures of brown-skinned people that is being placed beneath the desire to save specifically biological diversity. There's a realization that most of the areas we've tried to protect are rich in biodiversity, again, because the people who are living there had come to understand the value and mechanisms of biodiversity. And if you have a bunch of national parks throughout the world that are surrounded by angry and hungry people who describe themselves as enemies of conservation, those parks are probably doomed to fail. Interesting statistic about the continent of Africa. Most of its biodiversity, about 90%, exists outside of protected areas in the places where people live. And again, increasingly, there's this realization that many indigenous people have an encoded moral code and practical wisdom about treating the land with respect that we haven't quite caught on to in the same way. So let's do a couple of questions, and then we need to move on. Their hand over here.
I just wanted to observe that the situation in the Arctic wilderness is quite different because we're all destroying it without even getting close to it, as well as destroying the biodiversity and the indigenous culture through climate change.
Hmm. You mean climate change or oil extraction or both in the Arctic?
Well, climate change is universal up there. Oil extraction is local.
Yeah, thank you. Let's move on and talk a bit about indigenous perspectives and Native American perspectives on wilderness. Does anyone have quote B? Is it B at the beginning? Go ahead.
The idea of being lost in the wilderness logically necessitates a geographical reference conceptualized as home, as distinct from all other places. But for Paleolithic people, home was where they were and where they had always been. They could not become lost in the wilderness since it did not exist. Paleolithic people lacked a concept either of wilderness to escape or civilization to seek.
Thank you. And quote C, this is from a man named Luther Standing Bear.
We did not think of the Great Open Plains, a beautiful rolling hills and winding streams with tangled growth as wild. Only to the white man was nature a wilderness, and only to him was the land infested with wild animals and savage people. To us it was tame, earth was bountiful, and we were surrounded with the blessings of the great mystery.
Thank you. So we're going to dive once again into Muir. He ends up cropping up a lot, but he's a pretty important figure in all this. So in Muir's writings, he insisted that the Yosemite Valley and the Mariposa Grove and places like the Hetch Hetchy Valley had been unoccupied virgin wilderness before Euro-Americans arrived. And he was not oblivious to, but clearly ignored, the fact that there were northern Paiutes, Awanichis, and Miwok tribes in this valley and in the surrounding area, because he worked alongside them when he was working as something of a rancher or a shepherd up in the Tuolumne Meadows. He described them as fallen people. They were ugly, some of them altogether hideous. They had no place in the landscape. And he said that he experienced none of the solemn calm he expected of wilderness while in their presence. And although he acknowledged that their impact on the land was fairly minimal, he still had an extremely degrading view of them. Does anyone have quote D from John Muir?
The worst thing about them is their uncleanliness, for nothing truly wild is unclean. A mountain mansion where nature has gathered her choicest treasures to draw her lovers into close communion with her is simply not the place for such debased fellow beings.
So Muir maintained that these were just nomads. They were passing through, their presence there was temporary. It was very important to preserve this idea that he and his fellow Euro-American settlers were the first people to encounter the Yosemite Valley and see this land. And in truth, for thousands of years, the Indians had cultivated the valley with seeds, with bulbs to grow legumes, greens, flowers, and medicinal plants. They pruned the valley's trees and shrubs, they weeded the meadows, and they periodically burned the entire valley to clear the floor of unwanted brush and restore nutrients into the soil. So it's true that there were no permanent shelters and there were no fields that were plowed there, but what Muir saw was basically a tended wilderness. It was a productive rotational garden that had been cared for by hundreds of full-time gardeners for many, many hundreds of years. So he was told this, and he definitely observed it, but basically chose to ignore it to maintain this particular narrative that he needed to have exist. And we call this a historical fiction. He pretended that the Indians were just the first visitors, but they had never truly lived there or impacted the land. And I mentioned the other day, someone else who was responsible for this as well was Ansel Adams. When he would frame his photographs of Yosemite and elsewhere, he would very conscientiously exclude any sign of human habitation, any teepee, any structure, any individual human, in order again to maintain this historical fiction that there had been no human presence in this place until they arrived. When it looked like the Miwoks, which were one particular tribe of Native Americans in the valley, were not interested in leaving Yosemite as the park was formed, an Indian village was created. So in the valley, they established several huts of 6 to 8 people, allowed the Miwok Indians to live there, gave them underpaid jobs within the park, and then basically told them to do Indian things for the tourists, to weave, to crush acorns. It was basically a human zoo that was set up in the valley so that people could come and experience the way that Indians lived there. And then increasingly, they would either be fired, or as people in this village would die, they would reclaim, the Park Service would reclaim the shelters. And in the 60s, it was basically the last person left, and they used it. They set the whole thing on fire and used it as a fire drill for the Forest Service there. So basically, almost all major parks in the world followed the Yosemite example. First, it spread to the U.S., to Yellowstone, to Rainier, the Grand Canyon, Zion. Then it spread to Australia, Canada, and New Zealand. And then Europeans adopted the Yosemite model and applied it to their colonized lands in Africa, to the Transvaal and the Serengeti. Another thing that began to take place very strongly in America was the erasure of native presence through changing the names of places. They would change it from the native name and then use either some kind of biblical Judeo-Christian name, some kind of natural name, or sometimes it would just be named after someone that they knew. So a classic example of that is Mount Rainier, which, what's the true name of Mount Rainier?
Tahoma.
And it was named by Vancouver, correct? Vancouver named it after his friend Rainier back in Britain, who had never set eyes on the mountain.
A bunch of 18th century politicians got mountains named after them.
Yeah, Baker, Puget Sound, especially in the Northwest, there's an awful lot of things named after people back in Europe who never came here. So does anyone have quote E? This is from a Yupik native scientist up in Alaska.
E, you said?
Yeah, E.
Yeah. We have no word for wilderness. What you call wilderness, we call our backyard. To us, none of Alaska is defined by the 1960s Wilderness Act, a place without people. We are deeply insulted by that concept, as we are by the whole idea of wilderness designation that too often excludes native Alaskans from ancestral lands.
Thank you. And quote F, which is from... This is from Jacob Malas, a Komani hunter in the Kalahari.
I have an F.
Oh, yeah, go for it.
The Kalahari is like a big farmyard. It is not wilderness to us. We know every plant, animal, and insect and know how to use them. No other people could ever know and love this farm like us.
Thank you. Any comments or questions in this section?
It strikes me that this is a case where one of the ironies is the opening question around, you know, whether it would be appropriate to populate the natural parks. If you follow the line of thinking that you're saying, and I'm not in disagreement necessarily, but we would equally argue that we wouldn't want the Seminoles back in the Everglades, and yet they were displaced. And so it seems like in a broader historical perspective, it's true what Wayne's saying, that there's just too much population. And unless conservation is really handled carefully and more universally, I don't know how we would protect vast tracts of the earth. If you look at it, I looked at a JPL picture 20 years ago, one of the first pictures of the earth globally. And if you think of the Gaia thinking around the earth as an organism, and you look at the earth, the parts of the earth that appear to be dying are the parts of the earth that are populated by humans, all the big urban areas.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like the urban populations are defined now, and you're saying, what wilderness is. But at the same time, we're writing the history of it. So.
Any reactions to that, responses?
Yeah, I think it's a basic fear that we know as human beings, all human beings, we're going in there, we're going to tinker with it, and we're going to screw it up, and we can't stop. And there will always be a need to have the resources from there. And the more we populate, we're like a cancer wherever we are. And we have to learn to control our waste products and our... And make this circle that goes around so we can quit. I mean, the earth is just telling us in no uncertain terms that it isn't working.
Hmm.
But had we not taken the vast tracts of land like Yellowstone and the Everglades and the National Forest, then would they not be looking like Jackson Hole, Wyoming right now?
Mm-hmm.
And the people
that's
that actually populate those areas not be the rich folks that can afford the big chalets and cabins?
Hmm. In the back?
Boy, it's already moved so far. A couple of points. To your point about we are screwing everything up, we're like a cancer, my question is, who's we? You know, all human beings like cancer, or are we saying that there's the Westerners are the cancer and the indigenous people are normal, but then are we practically treating them as the high-level predators, and are we calling them animals? I mean, who's we? Is a question that I have.
Hmm.
By that same token, it seems a little arrogant to say that the population is growing out of control and somehow we have to control that. I don't think we know well enough what the population ought to be or what that history ought to be, future ought to be.
Hmm.
And perhaps you could argue that all this wilderness is just a savings account that we're going to have to draw on as our needs say we should have fewer people or we should grow at a slower rate than we're growing when we've got the lower birth rate.
Go ahead.
Just to follow up on the, we may have a lower birth rate, but one of us does a lot more harm to the planet than 10 people in Africa. We live heavily on the planet.
Yeah.
And we draw resources from a lot of these places. So, I mean, whenever I hear population control questions, the way it's, well, who? Because who gets control?
Hmm. Miranda, do you want to come in here and share your thought?
Back to the question of indigenous people and the land and expelling them for and the preserve. I would say that, at least in the North American context, that's just a subset of expelling indigenous people from the land. So we expel them from the land so we can make it agricultural. We expel them from the land so we can make it urban and industrial. We expel them from the land so we can have our preserves. And then we limit them into a small area. I wonder if that's the case in the Global South. I think it's more there of taking the indigenous people's culture away and forcing them to live in Western culture.
Thanks for that thought. Is there a hand back here?
Exposure leads to change. And yesterday's indigenous people may well be tomorrow's us. And maybe not on as aggressive a scale, but certainly with some degree change.
Do you think that transformation can ever go the other way?
I just don't know. It then becomes a bell jar, doesn't it?
Hmm.
How do you maintain a bell jar in society?
Oh, thanks.
From my perspective, population growth is a problem because there are three times as many people in this world as there were when I was born. In 70 years from now, there will probably be three times as many then. And the most extreme was Paul Ehrlich years ago, looked at the population growth rates and said in 700 years, overlooking the fact that it's impossible to do this, but if population was growing at that rate, the Earth would be a globe expanding at the speed of light with bodies.
Hmm.
So there has to be a limit somewhere.
Yeah, go ahead.
One thing that I've been kind of taking from this is there's these two perceptions of wilderness that somehow the white man's perception, and then you've got these indigenous people not seeing it as a wilderness but as their home and everything. I actually hiked in from Stehegan this morning, and we were at Image Lake a few nights ago, and we were just going to bed, just getting ready, putting all of our stuff away, hanging our bear, hanging everything, and this black bear comes about, maybe a football field away from our camp, and we'd seen some animals, but no bears yet, and so all of a sudden, everything changed, and like fear got in, and we were just like, we should make it through this night, and wake up, and then we can just hike out of here, and also there was kind of a storm coming in, and part of our discussions were, why do we have so much fear? That bear just passed by and we never saw him again. We saw his food down the trail. Why was there so much fear with this storm coming in? Like, are we prepared enough? Did we bring enough food? And it really exposed me to, with all my hiking experience and backcountry experience, to the fact that I have a very segmented view of what wilderness is. Even though I feel at home in it and very much myself in it, it's also this thing that's this entity that I don't control, I can't control, and so it instills fear in us rather than it isn't our homeland in a way. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes I wonder if our way of saying national park boundary, wilderness boundary, DNR land, whatever, is our way of controlling something that we can't control fundamentally in a way.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. I think we need to move on to our last segment, which is ecofeminism in the next 5 minutes. So, well, for starters, does anyone have an idea of what ecofeminism is? So have you heard that term before? Yeah? So this is the idea that women's bodies and nature are very closely associated. Both women's bodies and wilderness, for the sake of this discussion today, have been oppressed, have been dominated, have been devalued. They are both owned by men, men use it for their redemption. It has been controlled, used, explored, exploited, made subservient to men. It's an idea that you can draw a parallel between these two things. And wilderness has also been genderized. Oftentimes we'll use feminine pronouns to refer to nature or wilderness. And we also use words like virgin wilderness quite often. So if we accept that both wilderness and women's bodies have been desired by men for a long time, can anyone take a stab at how maybe we see a little bit of patriarchy at work in that?
Sounds like men came up with that idea.
Do you all agree?
Agree that a man came up with the idea?
Uh-huh.
Okay, we're just trying to figure out what, do we agree with the idea that a man came up with the idea that wilderness is female, is feminine?
Maybe let's stick with trying to understand patriarchy at work in the connection between women's bodies and wilderness.
Something to be dominated.
Uh-huh.
Something to be kept pure.
Mm-hmm.
Something men are afraid of.
Mm. And completely misunderstand. with this idea of virgin, what I'm hearing is, there's like this appetite for virgins and for virgin land, for virgin bodies that comes from, I think, a male desire to control completely, to be sort of the monotheistic god of its domain, whether that be woman or the land.
Thanks. Does anyone have quote F out there? This is by theologian Carolyn Merchant.
In the traditional meaning of the virgin original Eve is the compliant, pristine bride of Adam, land ripe for consumption, for development. After her disruption of the male oneness of the garden, woman reverts to fallen Eve, sinful woman as abandoned, disorderly wasteland. Fallen Eve can be redeemed and given positive value through male, human agency, and science, which render her again the productive, fruitful wife and mother, her fertility controlled and turned to the nurture of her husband's children as wild land gives way to the developed, improved garden.
Thank you. So there's a couple of problems with associating wilderness with virginity. One of them is that it makes the untouched land, the wilderness land, seem like the exception. It's exceptional, it's abnormal, it's not the norm. And then that makes the norm all of the degraded land, all of the violated, developed land. So again, this is just one theory, that when we elevate virgin wilderness to this exceptional, abnormal place, then everything else is normal. It's to be expected. It's to be accepted. That's what we do to land. Another idea is that it reinforces this dualism. Either you're a virgin or you're not a virgin. Either the land is pristine and untouched and pure, or it's not. And that means that even land that has been slightly affected is no longer given the same status as this pure, untouched land. So we might think of Copper Mountain and say, is it because it's been mined? Some would use the word raped. Can we still think of this as completely pure, untouched wilderness? And if we don't, is it valued somehow less than a mountain that has not been mined at all? Any thoughts on that?
I don't know what you call pure, but I don't think 80 acres of table is pristine.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But doesn't need to be pristine to be beautiful.
Yeah, but it's spoiled.
Mm-hmm.
We also got $200 million worth of revenue out of it, and it was the product of that mountain helped defeat Nazism. But we could exclude that from the discussion, and then therefore we just are left with an environmental mess.
Other comments? It gets into some pretty heavy theoretical stuff here. Go ahead.
Also, men can be virgins too.
This is very true. However.
That's great. That's wonderful.
It's true. It's true. But when you think of a virgin, does a guy pop in your mind?
I think it's true.
Virgin male is ridiculous.
Well, it might to mine. Maybe not to yours. Men, yeah.
Vessel virgins. I mean, men.
Yeah, I see both.
I think that the virginity of women has been, throughout history in many cultures, been prized more highly than the virginity of men, and that word has come to be more associated with women than men. We're pretty much out of time, but I want to offer room for any last comments, or if people want to stick around and keep talking. There's been a lot of really good ideas here. Go ahead.
I just wanted to say, I've been reading a lot of Joseph Campbell lately, and he speaks to a great extent about nature of women in mythology and men in mythology. And this is a quote of his, and in that I don't think it's necessarily bad that there's a connotation between nature and nurturing in women. The quote, "The mythological figure of the universal mother imputes to the cosmos the feminine attributes of the first nourishing and protecting presence. This fantasy is primarily spontaneous, for there exists a close an obvious correspondence between the attitude of the young child toward its mother and that of the adult toward the surrounding material world." So when you talk about women being more aligned with nature, I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It may have been written by men in some way that in many cases can be picked apart as derogatory, but I don't think that the fundamental basis in and of itself is a bad
thing. Any reactions to that?
Well, I just comment not directly to that, but I think we'd better understand all of these concepts if we really, truly understood animal behavior. We don't understand animal behavior.
Well, that's what we are.
Yeah, I think we should be careful when we work with metaphors of any kind, because a metaphor that means something to me might not mean the same thing to you. And whoever came up with the metaphor comparing women to the land is in a certain frame of reference that some of us aren't in.
Well, on that note, is there one more comment back here? Nope. Well, thank you everyone for coming and contributing your good ideas this